From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people of the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, remembering the Dust Bowl, the people who suffered, and the lessons about nature that should never be forgotten.
They've always had drought. Drought is part of the Southern Plains. I mean, it goes back hundreds, thousands of years. Long, epic droughts are part of the plains. And they've always had high wind episodes. I mean, high winds are part of the plains. The only thing that was different in the 1930s was the grass was gone.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm Dave Davies. It was a vast area covered in grass that was once called the Great American Desert. But when settlers began to arrive, the name the Great Plains took hold. Soon word spread that cheap, fertile farmland was available to anyone who would work it. In a matter of decades, the land was ruined by over-farming and drought. And in 1931, the Black Blizzards started. These powerful dust storms became a plague on the settlements. The blowing mountains of dirt killed livestock and people. And it all came to bear just as the worst of the Depression hammered the nation's economy. A reporter called it the Dust Bowl, and that name stuck.
Drought leaves its mark for 1935. Dust storms bury Kansas and Colorado farms. It lasted, fortunately, only a few weeks, and a prosperous harvest erased the harrowing memories.
It became known as one of the nation's worst natural disasters, but it wasn't natural at all. As Timothy Egan writes in his book, The Worst Hard Time, the Dust Bowl was caused by man and greed.
One of the reasons I focus on Texas, because in one generation's time, the early part of the 20th century, the panhandle of Texas went through one of the most remarkable transitions of any large patch of ground on the planet Earth. I mean, it went from the world's greatest grassland, the southern anchor of the Great Plains that used to have this huge bison herd on it, to this massive cattle ranch that I'm sure most Texans are familiar with, the XIT Ranch, 3 million acres. At one time, it was the largest ranch under fence in the world, to being so heavily farmed, so hammered by wheat farmers, and the cattle removed, the bison removed, the cowboys removed, that the land itself then lifted itself off in this great peeling rolls of dust that darkened the skies and brought, you know, noontime suddenly became midnight. People hovered back into their sod houses and their dugouts. So you had this incredibly, in this incredibly short period of time, you had people go from, you know, this great grassland living good lives to these wheat farms being briefly prosperous to being basically a subsistence lifestyle. I mean, back, they sent a telegram out of one of the towns in Texas that said 80% of our people are in desperate need of food right now in semi-starvation. I also was really interested in the dynamics at play in Dalhart, Texas, where you had this booster, John McCarty, famous newspaper man who ran the Daily Texan there in Dalhart. And he vowed that he would not print any more bad news at the height of the Dust Bowl and also the depth of the Great Depression when 25% of people were out of work. And he started this last man's club, which just captivated the nation. You have newsreel footage of this. He got up there and gave these fiery speeches. He looked like Orson Welles, and he said, I'll be the last man to leave my beloved patch of Texas, and I want everyone to sign up and follow me here. And so they signed this last man's club card saying they would never leave Dalhart, Texas. Well, guess who was one of the first to leave? John McCarty. But others, one of the people I focus on, a guy named Doc Dawson, when he died, his son found inside his wallet this withered-up old card that was his last man's club card.
You cover a number of interesting personalities, all of them going through some hardships. Hard to believe that people could survive that. I mean, and the whole book really is this one terrible story after another. How did you manage to survive writing a book that has so many sad stories in it?
And Dave, it was a time so unlike ours and a land so unlike any land we've ever seen since that at times you know, I just let the people talk in parts of the book because most people, they know, the folks who are around now who are in their 80s and 90s who have lived to tell this remarkable story but will be in their grave soon in just a few years. I mean, this story is in danger of slipping away. They know that a lot of people do not believe them. I mean, they know that when you say there was a time when the sky went black at midday and there was a wall of dust moving towards you that looked like the Rocky Mountain Range, the Front Range on the move itself, and there was a time when there was so much static electricity in the air that you couldn't shake another man's hand because you'd get electrocuted, you'd get shocked, that is, that people dragged chains below their cars to ground the static, that they don't believe them. So as I started to gather these stories and get oral histories and go from towns in the Texas Panhandle and the Oklahoma Panhandle, which is formerly called No Man's Land, and other parts of the Dust Bowl, that was the epicenter, by the way, you know, I got as many details as I could because I wanted to make sure you couldn't just say it was a horrible time and it was all this. You had to recreate what had happened. And I knew people would have a hard time believing it unless they saw it, felt it, you know, felt the dust in their mouth. And the thing that it's done to change me is, I mean, I like to think I will never complain again about some basic, simple thing in my life. I mean, hey, my cable's out. How awful is that? These people were starving, many of them. They were, you know, they would can tumbleweed. They would brine it and can tumbleweed. Their animals had all died. Some of them had to give up their children. They showed up on courthouse steps and offered to give up their children, saying, we just can't feed them anymore. We're afraid they won't live. Many of these stories broke my heart, but others of them just so inspired me. And I have to say, despite the fact that the folks themselves who farmed this were largely responsible for what happened because they overfarmed, they were heroic. I mean, these people just blew me away. They were extraordinary folks.
It was the frontier stock, the people who settled the West, and then they had to deal with the fallout from over-farming, which was interesting because I was never really clear prior to reading your book about how did the Dust Bowl come about. I knew it happened in the middle of the Depression, but I always thought it was just strange that this terrible natural disaster would happen right at the time where we're having this huge economic disaster, and it turns out that they're actually linked together.
Absolutely. One came with the other. The natural world fell apart, and then the man-made world fell apart. The thing about the farming that happened there, Dave, was that they treated wheat like California treated gold during the California Gold Rush. For a brief period of time, you could become rich as a wheat farmer. There hasn't really been a time since then unless you're a big subsidy, corporate subsidy person. But, you know, wheat went from like 50 cents a bushel to $2 a bushel to $3 a bushel to $4 a bushel. And overnight, people were just getting rich or making pretty good living off this dryland farming, which didn't require any irrigation. You'd plow up the grass, the great Texas grass. You throw in some seed in the fall, and you come back in the spring when it's up, and then you harvest it in the summer. And so they had these people called suitcase farmers that would show up just with their suitcases and weren't really interested in sticking around. And they would plow up some ground, throw some seed in, and come back in the summer. And for a while, it all worked pretty well. But then wheat crashed. There was a huge oversupply of it. And the grain would rot at all these, you know, terminals along the trains along the railroad tracks. And grain became worth nothing. And what did people do? They all had loans. The only way to cover their nut, they felt, was to plow up even more grass so that they could get at least something to get enough to cover the note. And then it all imploded. And, of course, you know, I mean, it was a strange situation because people were reduced to doing things like clubbing rabbits, which they didn't do, interestingly, for food. They did it because the natural world was so out of whack that there was a surfeit of rabbits and a surfeit of grasshoppers, too, by the way. One of my heroes in the book is a fellow named Melt White, and he's half Indian, half Anglo, and he's ashamed of his Indian side because his family had told him not to let anyone know that, but it turns out he's a great lover of open skies and cow and then horses and everything like that. And, you know, he talked about when he was a kid, his mama wouldn't let him go to these rabbit drives because, you know, everybody would turn out in their Sunday school best and club, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 rabbits in their corral, and the blood would be everywhere. And he went to one, and he never got over the haunting squealing he heard. He said he could always hear the rabbits sort of squealing, making a sound, sort of a sighing sound after they were clubbed, and it haunted him till his last days. He's still alive, by the way, and lives next to the old XIT ranch. I try not to criticize. I try to just lay out what happened and let people judge. But the reason they did these rabbit roundups is because what little things were growing at the height of the Dust Bowl, they felt that the rabbits were out there chewing it all, as well as the grasshoppers. The reason there were so many rabbits is because all the predators were dead. The natural world itself was just totally out of whack.
the happenings of the Dust Bowl, although people now are forgetting about it, it was pretty well documented. Photographs are incredible. The stories have been written. Even a documentary was made about it, Plow That Broke the Plains, which was a tremendous success as a government-funded documentary.
Yeah, great point. It's one of the most well-documented incidents in our history, and though most people have forgotten about it, or what they think of it, they think of from John Steinbeck's masterpiece, The Grapes of Wrath. And, you know, that was a great book, but that dealt with the people who left. And the more interesting story to me was that most people did not leave. Two-thirds of all the people living at the epicenter of the Dust Bowl stayed behind and lived and hunkered down and went into their dugouts and dealt with all these storms because they thought tomorrow would be better. But it was very well documented. President Franklin Roosevelt sent an essential army of photographers and documentarians along with the Civilian Conservation Corps workers to record this. So there are thousands and thousands of pictures to go through, just gripping, incredible stuff where you not just see the storms as they move along, but you see the pain in the faces and the people, that sort of the heartache that's etched into their faces. And The Plow That Broke the Plains, which is part documentary and part manipulated film. I mean, they wrote in some narrative in the background, but that captures some of the storms in and of itself, including bits and pieces of Black Sunday, which was the worst dust storm of all time.
Woody Guthrie found himself caught in some of these dust storms, dusters or
black blizzards. Yeah, Woody was sitting down in Texas in a little house, and he was just getting going. Nobody knew who he was then, and this was Black Sunday, April 14th, 1935, a time when as much ground was thrown to the sky in one day as was emptied out in 7 years to build the Panama Canal. And as the storm moved down from the Dakotas and came down through Kansas, Colorado, through the Oklahoma Panhandle and into Texas, Woody went into this room. He cowered into this room with these other people, and they were all gathered around this one light bulb. He said it looked like the embers, like that lit end of a cigarette after a while. And then the room itself went dark, and people started saying, the apocalypse is here, the end is here, the world as we know is coming to an end. And Woody said, I heard this from an oral history of him I listened to, where Woody said he came up with the first lines of a song, "So long, it's been good to know ya."
So long, it's been good to know ya. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is a-blowing me home. I've got to be rolling along. I'll sing it again of the place that I lived on the West Texas plains. In the city of Pampa, the county of Gray, here's what all of the people there say. Well, it's so long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. Dusty old dust is a-blowing me home. I've got to be drifting along.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. We are talking with Timothy Egan, author of The Worst Hard Time, the untold story of those who survived the Dust Bowl.
It turns out after the farmers plowed up the plains and then they had a dry year and it blew all the topsoil off the plains, that the soil went even as far as Washington, D.C. and New York City.
Isn't that amazing? That was one of the first things that blew me away when I started to research this book. There were two storms that blew soil not only to Washington, D.C., but I'll tell you about one in 1934. It covered New York City. I mean, they had a health alert. People went out, turned their streetlights on at 1 in the afternoon, and a fine film of dust covered Manhattan, about an eighth of an inch thick of dust. And people were sort of panicked. They didn't know what was going on. At that point, and this is well documented, they measured the dust storm itself at 1,400 miles long. So the eastern end was, it just touched Manhattan, but the western end, which was tailing it behind it, was all the way back into the western part of the Midwest. That storm blew out and even affected ships at sea in the Atlantic Ocean several hundred miles off the coast. The one in 1935, Black Sunday, not only blew dust into the Oval Office, the president's office, but the founder of the Soil Conservation Service, Hugh Bennett, was making a presentation before the Senate, and he was trying to convince his senators that they should create what would then be the world's first Soil Conservation Service, which, by the way, is the last legacy left over from the New Deal that survives on a grassroots level. So Bennett had been told the storm was moving closer and closer, that this massive black cloud that had started in Texas and the Midwest was now moving closer and closer. And he paused and he filibustered and he delayed his speech. And finally a person came up to him and said, "It's here." And Bennett pointed out to the window, and they looked outside, and it went dark in the afternoon. And you could see the dust blowing through. And Hugh Bennett turned to the senators and said, "This, gentlemen, is what I'm talking about." Well, that day they passed a measure that created the Soil Conservation Service, and the next day Roosevelt signed it.
So it took a government solution, government involvement, to try to actually solve this problem.
Yeah, it did. And you know what's interesting about that to compare to our politics now? The people were clamoring for it. They were begging the government to come save them. They wrote telegrams. They wrote letters. Their congressmen and senators all urged that the federal government, the executive level, send people out for help. They were desperate. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know why the land was acting this way. And when the civilian conservation workers showed up, they did things like plant trees. Roosevelt wanted to have this giant tree belt going from the Canadian border to Mexico, and he thought maybe if he had this shelter belt, as he called it, people could farm between the trees, and that would keep the wind down. And so these CCC workers would show up, and they'd be housed at the edge of Dalhart, for example, and living in tents, and the people welcomed them because it brought money into their town and because they were trying to do something. And then he showed them how to contour the land. They started these soil conservation districts where they would rest certain plots of ground. And a number of scholars who've studied the Dust Bowl and what happened concluded that that was largely responsible for the fact that we have never had a recurrence. I mean, here's the thing to remember about the Southern Plains, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware of. They've always had drought. Drought is part of the Southern Plains. I mean, it goes back hundreds, thousands of years. Long, epic droughts are part of the plains. And they've always had high wind episodes. I mean, high winds are part of the plains. The only thing that was different in the 1930s was the grass was gone. They'd ripped up the sod that held the land in place. So that's why most people concluded that this was not a natural disaster in the strictest sense of it. It was largely a human-caused disaster. They also tried, Dave, to restore the grassland, which was one of the more interesting experiments there. That to this day, if you drive through the heart of the old Dust Bowl, you'll see what are called national grasslands. They're run by the Forest Service. There are 11 million acres that are national grasslands. And they, you know, they've been somewhat successful. They may return buffalo there as well soon.
Willie, what's the worst dust storm you ever saw, if you're ever in yourself?
Well, the worst one I ever seen was on the 14th day of April in 1935. I was living at that time about 60 miles north of Amarillo, Texas, up on the plains there. They're 3,600 feet high, just as flat as a floor, 1,000 miles wide, and anything in the world stopped that wind with just a barbed wire fence. About 100 miles north of there, and it ain't got a barb on it. I showed you that picture a while ago, where it looked like a ocean was chomping on a snail. That's just the way that dust storm looked when it hit our town. It was the 14th day of April, 1935. There come the blackest dust storm. Their little shacks, you couldn't
not see their faces. It was so deathly black. We lit our lamps and lanterns. We set them in our rooms, but could not pierce the darkness. We thought it was our doom.
Has written a book about the Dust Bowl, which includes parts of North Texas and the Panhandle in the 1930s. The book is called The Worst Hard Time.
There were people that actually predicted that this would happen and warned many of these farmers to be careful about plowing up so much of the grassland, or else they would create an ecological disaster. Of course, they didn't have that terminology at the time, which kind of has a strange echoing or maybe even a foreshadowing of what's happening now as people are warning about possible climate change.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the parallels then to now, but you're exactly right. There weren't any so-called environmentalists or ecologists. These were foreign terms then. You know who warned of the coming disaster? It was a bunch of cowboys. It was people who used the grass for cattle. People who ran cattle over this beautiful grassland, because buffalo had lived there as well. This is the greatest grassland in the world. It was. And there's a famous line I found from a Kiowa Indian. The Kiowas used to live there as well, the Apaches, the Kiowas, the Comanche. They lived quite well on this grassland, on the bison that roamed over it. And when they first started turning the sod upside down, a Kiowa turned to an American and he said, he pointed out the grass and he said, wrong side up. And a lot of these cowboys warned it. There were these range wars, you know, between the so-called nesters, the homesteaders who wanted to plow it up, and the cowboys who were running cattle over this ground, the XIT, and they said, it's grass. Leave it as it is. And they said, if you keep going at this pace, you know, nature's going to get its revenge. And it's that, you know, there was a famous headline that ran after the San Francisco earthquake in 1989. It was, nature bats last. And that's what happened in the Dust Bowl. Nature batted last. And pretty much extracted. I wouldn't want to say it's revenge because that would be anthropomorphizing, but it, you know, it extracted its toll for what had been done. Now, the parallels today are interesting because not just for climate change, which we have so many warnings that, you know, we are heating up the earth because of so many CO2 emissions, but also with what's happening down there with the Oglala Aquifer. You know, underlying most of the Great Plains is this huge lake. It's great. It's about the size of the Great Lakes of water. And it's being pumped up now at a rate that cannot be sustained. This is water now that is used for most of the big farms in Texas and Oklahoma, parts of Colorado, parts of Kansas. And there's been a lot of studies that say at the rate that we're pumping up this water now, it'll be gone fairly soon by the end of this century. And as you know, there isn't a lot of water from, you know, stream flows. So that's basically it. And so we have it out there to see what we can do. This story I told, I was interested in it in part because it's a tale of hubris. It's a tale of what happens when you push and push and push against nature, and then nature pushes back. But I have to say also, as you alluded to earlier, I really admired the people. Though they did rip up this grassland, a lot of them were lured by government and the railroad stations. They were these last chancers. They were people who came, Germans who had lived in Russia under the Tsar and were pacifists who fled it. There were Scots-Irish folks who were left over from the old Confederacy. There were Mexicans who came up from the South. They got a chance of something, and they were heroic and enduring and trying to stay on the land. And now, of course, so much of that area is dying. The small towns, you see them drifting away, and You see the population diminishing. I think something like 3/4 of all the counties in the Texas Panhandle lost population in the last census. And so, you know, there's a real sadness on the land right now.
How is Dalhart today, 75 years after the Dust Bowl?
You know, it's changed in this sense. It's lost, I think, and I may not be entirely accurate on this, I'm drawing this on memory, it's lost somewhere about 30% of its population since it had in the 1930s. Its glory days, it was a town created in 1900, and its glory days were in the teens and 20s, and then it declined starting with the Dust Bowl and never really recovered. There are three highways that meet through there. You know, we're not a nation of farmers anymore, and that's the problem around Dalhart and every other place there because, you know, we were founded as a nation of farmers. And even at the start of the 20th century and well into the 1930s, something like 30% of all Americans worked in some way on the land or had jobs related to agriculture. And now it's only about 1%, 1.5%. So Dalhart, you know, it still stands. I found Milt White there, the old cowboy I alluded to earlier. They have a magnificent museum to the XIT Ranch, and, you know, there is sort of a haunt to it. I mean, as I was trying to imagine what it was like in the 1930s and all my characters and the heroes I wrote about walking around there and looking at the pictures of it during its glory days, and then, you know, it was a fine, upstanding town, and then the dusters just hammered the crap out of it. It's like a lot of those places in the Southern Plains. It has a sort of a gritty courage, and a, you know, it's trying to hold on. But I'm really not sure what its future is.
Is there a memorial anywhere to the Dust Bowl and the people who survived it?
Boy, what a great question. None that I could find. The best memorial to them, I think, is this oral history archive at the Oklahoma Historical Society, which I relied on quite a bit. And they've recorded a lot of interviews with the folks who lived through this awful time. And so you hear their voices and you can understand some of the pain that they went through and also why they hung on. And every town has a little museum, some little attic to the past. And I really relied on that a lot, too. I'd go into town and say, you know, who knows the story? And they'd say, direct me to someone at the edge of town who's been around. And those folks would then bring out pictures. First, they'd bring out the pictures so I would believe them. Because when they start talking about this, they know nobody believes them. But that's a good question. I don't think there's a central memorial in the sense that there's a memorial to the wars that we fought.
Back in 1927, I had a little farm and I called it heaven. Price was up and the rain come down and I hauled my crops all into town. I got the money, bought clothes and groceries, fed the kids, took it easy. The rain it quit and the wind got high and the black old dust storms filled the sky and I swapped my farm for a Ford machine and I filled it full of this gas I lean and started rolling and drifting to California. Way up yonder on a mountain road, I had a hot motor and a heavy load. I was going pretty fast, I wasn't even stopping. I was bouncing up and down like popcorn a-popping, had a breakdown. Sort of a nervous bust down of the mechanism there, some kind of engine trouble. Here's a way up yonder on a mountain road, I wasn't feeling so very good, and I give this rolling Ford a shove, and I was going to coast as fur as I could. Commenced rolling, picking up speed, and there was a hairpin turn, and I couldn't make it. Man alive, I'm a...
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please write to us at texasmatters@tpr.org. And join us again next week for another edition of Texas Matters on Texas Public Radio.